The following podcast may contain mature themes and coarse language. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to the No Fear Project Podcast. I'm your co-host, Pete D'Amico. That's right, co-host. We are back for season two, and there's going to be a few changes, starting with my incredible co-host, a past guest on the show, Nicole Wilds. Nicole, I'm stoked to have you here.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, so this episode is going to be just kind of getting to know you. Everybody kind of knows way too much about me at this point, if they've listened. If you haven't, just go back to the beginning, go listen to Fat Man Chronicles, our another podcast I do, and I'm pretty much out there in the podcast sphere with way too much info about myself, but we don't know enough about you, so that's where okay. We're going to start today.
Well, that's exciting, I think.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It is for me. Yeah. All right, so why don't we just start with kind of a little bit about you, kind of where you're from, a little bit about your background, and then we'll work up to some Q&A.
Okay. Well, I'm a Jersey girl, so I will try to watch my language.
No need.
But I currently live in the suburbs of Philly right now. And let's see. Well, career-wise, I was a teacher. And then we moved to Pennsylvania. My teaching license didn't carry over. So I got a job in publishing, which was phenomenal and fun and glamorous and one of my favorite jobs ever. And then I had a baby, which left me not wanting to be trapped in Chicago for, you know, 4 extra days due to a snowstorm. And then just did a complete career shift and became a licensed professional counselor.
So with your publishing side, you were traveling a lot. Was that the gig?
Mm-hmm.
And you came to visit us here in Chicago often?
We did a couple times. Boston and Chicago were the two main cities. But I was basically stationed in central Pennsylvania. So I was the lady who, when a district bought a new reading program or a math program, I would go in and work with the teachers after school. And so I would teach them how to use their new products. And what I discovered in that role was that not so much that I was great at teaching the teachers how to teach investigative math or the new math that they're doing, but I was really good at soothing a group of anxious teachers, you know? And then that sort of became this theme that kept showing up in my life. And then I would have friends who would introduce me, you know, and they'd be like, oh, she's like my therapist. And, you know, I feel that when the universe keeps giving you enough evidence that you ought to be moving in a certain direction, why not listen to it? Right. So that then led to the therapy route.
Yeah. With remote school and my shift to having to be I don't know, whatever you want to call it, a teacher's aide, a teacher, a parent that has to do things that he never thought he would have to do. I promise that this will not just be a therapy session for me.
Okay.
I know that people are probably worried about that. Like, this guy's messed up and now he's got to teach virtually. This could just turn into a therapy session, but it won't. That's the promise. So
well, I think,
go ahead.
Well, I think as someone who's in the same boat as you are right now we call it being the virtual assistant. If we were to do that, then we should pull in my therapist and then we can just have a full blown, you know, group session. That would work.
Yeah. Right. I know. And it's interesting, right? Because we are in the middle of a pandemic, and I say that not for people who will listen now, but maybe somebody pulls this up in 10 years and goes, oh yeah, there was a pandemic. At least that's what I'm hoping, mm-hmm. you know, like right. We can get through this. But what is it like just right now being a therapist in the midst of what 2020, this dumpster fire that we have going on?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would say right now, I have never seen, I've never had clients who, you know, for whom I haven't seen in years. They went through a couple round, you know, they went through therapy, they graduated, and I always leave the door open. And I mean, I would say at least 3, 4, 5 times a week in texts from clients I haven't heard from who are, you know, are you still doing therapy? Are you accepting clients? Because people are really struggling. And then sometimes I sit down across from my therapist and I go, it's like really bad, right? You know, and she'll go, oh yeah, it's definitely really bad. Because sometimes I wonder, is it just me? Is it just the bubble I'm in? I know people in different locations. They're having very different experiences than what we're having. Some of us are having over in Pennsylvania. And yeah, so it's, people are just, the anxiety is just through the roof with people.
Yeah, I love that you've mentioned now a couple times your therapist. I think that's one of the things that I really admire about you is you're open about the fact that, look, therapists need a therapist, right? And there's no shame in that. And as you know, one of the big goals of the No Fear Project is to defeat the stigma of mental health issues, because fear is directly related to mental health issues. And I know I just read a study about political bent in fear and kind of how that goes. And I just kept saying to myself, that's such bullshit, because I know people who are just the opposite, right? These studies come out and they generalize a bunch of stuff, and then people latch onto it like it's a binary option. Like it's either A or it's B, it's black or it's white. And that's not at all the way it is. And especially right now, the world we're living in. And I can imagine with what's getting thrown at you, both as a mother of school age kids and a therapist, that it's good to have somebody to lean on that's not a spouse or a friend.
Yeah, Holly's great. We love Holly. And it was midway through the lockdown in the spring where I thought, oh yeah, I'm moving into a place where I definitely could use some support. And fortunately she still had some openings. Sometimes she's a little tricky to get in with, but yeah. And I started with her back for, well, actually in the office. She was one of the first people, because I hadn't really left the house in a long time. And she had kept her practice open because in Pennsylvania, therapists are considered essential workers. The practice that I work for has been virtual since March. But she kept her practice open. And I just remember going in there and having this experience of like, oh, people, like actual people, not the tiny humans I created and my husband, but someone new. And it was crazy how it was like the highlight of my week, you know? And yeah, so then, but the one thing I do want to say is I've done the therapy route a couple times in my 43 years. And for me, whenever I went to a therapist and I felt as if they were sort of from this keeper of knowledge position, you know, where they just, they were the one with all the information and I was to abide, it was never a good match for me. You know, and so the therapy that I work with, which is called acceptance and commitment therapy, I work with a couple orientations, but that's the one that I follow probably the most. They're very clear on, you are not the keeper of knowledge. You know, the client is the expert on them. And it's like, you're climbing your own mountain and I'm climbing my mountain, and I can see sides of your mountain from where I sit. But if you were my therapist, you'd be able to see the sides that I can't see. You know, and so this idea of being able to just, you know, we're all just doing this human thing. And so let's just be in it together. That's been really important to me. You know, when clients are like, oh, I love when you give me advice. I'm like, your friends give you advice. I don't give you, sometimes I give advice, but for the most part, I don't, you know, my job is to get them to trust what they already know to be true. And that's, I get sad when I hear people say that their therapist, you know, is like their expert on their life, because that's not the intention behind therapy.
Yeah, I could say that from going to therapy myself, you know, several times over the course of many years, the question that always got me from the therapist was when I was finally, you know, like I was on a path, and they, and it was one gentleman in particular, and he would just ask me, "Are you sure?" And that question is loaded. It's three little words.
Yeah.
With the with a little question mark at the end, but it's loaded because it makes you take stock of, okay, am I just trying to convince myself of something? Or, you know, I guess where he was coming from is, look, you don't have to have an answer. And that was my favorite part of going to him. He's retired now, unfortunately, after a bout with COVID. But he was always like, look, you're looking for answers, and answers aren't really my goal. My goal is to get you to kind of look inside, ask better questions, and then come up with strategies on how to move forward. But he's like, if you want all answers, he's like, you probably need religion more than you need therapy. So, you know, that was kind of his take. And I never asked what style or like, I hear, you know, acceptance and commitment therapy. I hear other terms, and for me, that was less important than about the therapist themselves. For others, you know, knowing what that basis is probably going to be hardcore important to them. Like, I do this, right? And I need, you know, this path. I need acceptance and commitment therapy because XYZ. So I think it's very interesting. And having your perspective on the show going forward, I think, is going to be great, because we definitely come from different angles, although we have plenty of similarities. You know, parenting is like this universal bond, so we definitely have that, right? But I've never been a therapist, but I've been in plenty of therapy. I feel like I right now I'm not a teacher, right? But I'm doing plenty of that too, right? So you get like bits and pieces and different viewpoints, and when you're immersed in it, it becomes very interesting. But I would never portend to ask the right questions you know, to anybody. But what I'm really good at is listening. So I think that's probably why I wanted to become a podcaster in general, is I like stories. I like to hear people's stories. My own voice too, obviously, but you know, we all have that.
Which is super similar to therapy, right? I mean, I love getting to the core of what makes someone light up.
Right.
That is by far the coolest thing, and listening to the obstacles and the stories and the experiences that came that hijacked them from knowing their true self.
Right.
You know, that's just so fun to unpack with people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that gives really good background on kind of who you are today, a therapist, but we don't know enough about you. So like, what are some of your passions? What do you love to do?
Well, I'm in Florida right now, on a workcation, and this is also the first time I've been away from anyone, any of the tiny humans, since March. And, I am spending the entire, technically it's 5 days, but you know, you have the 2 days are travel days, so I feel like they don't count. But the 3 days that I'm here, besides this podcast, I have been writing nonstop. And that for me is the thing that brings me, it's just so much joy. And it's the thing that helps me to get into that flow state where it feels like 10 hours feels like 5 minutes, you know, and people will say, you should take a break. And I'm like, I don't even want you. Like, this is so much fun to be able to focus on this. And I can feel myself coming back to myself, you know, just kind of filling the tank back up again, because the virtual schooling and then having the summer off with the kids and then virtual schooling again. There's just, I think when you're a creative person, so many people are so down on themselves right now for not accomplishing all of the things that they think they should do because they're still in the house. And I don't think people understand how much of their energy gets depleted by the management of what's going on and then the lack of opportunities to do the things that refill the tank. And so for me, I know that my tank has been on E for a pretty long time. Like the highlight of my week should not be going to therapy, right? Like it needs to be more than that. I'm like another human and I get to talk about myself and just focus on me for, you know, 49 to 52 minutes. But now just having spent the last 3 days doing this, it's almost, I think I'm reminded how it can't be negotiable. I have to make this part, this piece of me, a non-negotiable and a necessity, not a luxury, you know, moving forward. So, yeah, so writing is next to hearing people's, I mean, this sounds super dramatic, but I'm not really great at small talk. I can do it because, you know, I've studied the social skill aspect of it, but, other than sitting down with someone and being like, okay, what's in your soul? You know, what makes you tick? What's your gift? What's your passion? I love like getting to know that part of people. I would say writing is the other thing that I feel like I could do forever.
Yeah, right now I just have a picture of you like locked in a room, pizza boxes, wrappers, Red Bull, energy, yeah. Like 5-hour energy, just like strewn all over the place. And you just typing furiously at a keyboard.
So, yeah.
Is that pretty close?
Well, no, I am trying to lighten up a little bit. So we went here, we bought spinach. I'm making these like spinach kale smoothies. I call them my I'd rather be fat shakes. but they're, you know, after the fifth one, you find yourself craving them. So it's more of that.
Okay, good.
Sort of healthier style. but definitely just, yeah, like I go into this, it's very frenetic. And when the person that I'm with, she came in the room last night because she had a Zoom call. So I sort of hid in the room instead of being in the main area. And she came in and I was like, one second. Because I had, if someone interrupts when I have the thought flowing in, then I lose the thought completely, you know, the thing that I'm writing. So, or the sentence, I should say, I lose the sentence.
So this for you is a big deal because you haven't been able to, or haven't taken the time. I can't say haven't been able. I think that's unfair, but you haven't been right. able for whatever reason to take the time to focus on this project, which obviously gets you all amped up and geeked out about it. Right.
Yeah.
Do you feel pressure to accomplish something in particular while you're there for 3 days, or is this more just a catalyst in your mind to launch being able to do this more consistently?
Well, I have two parts, right? So my perfectionist part is, you know, had this idea of, and I'd like to say recovering perfectionist part, but it still shows up every once in a while. But no, of course I had this incredibly unrealistic expectation that I was going to just, excuse the expression, but go balls to the wall for 3 days and finish the entire book. The book at this point, I started writing this book I started dabbling with the book in June of 2018. And then I would only write on Wednesdays and I would just play with the story a little bit. And then last summer was when I got very serious about it. And I was committing to 2 days a week to just writing as much as I could. And also not knowing how to write a book, not being an English major, I didn't know. I had the story, but I don't really know how to write a book. But I just know that when I do it, it feels really, really good. So I kept doing it. And then the pandemic hit and then I stopped. And so there was the fantasy of finishing the book this week. But what I realized when I was here is that the cleaning it up and getting the outline and being very clear as to why this scene is going to move the story forward to the next scene requires so much thinking, and it needs to be uninterrupted thinking. So if I could get that done while I'm here, I will be ecstatic. So it's because then I could go home and just rip out the story. Part of my problem is that sometimes I'm very precious about things and super dramatic, you know, whereas I could easily probably go upstairs and lock myself in the room for an hour and get it done. I get precious about it. Like, oh, I need the entire, you know, I need no distractions ever. And I have to have a certain amount of energy and, you know.
Yeah, because that happens in life all the time. So you'll be able to finish that in the next 20 years.
Yeah, hopefully. right?
Well, yeah. Right. So, I mean, I heard story and scene. So you're writing something that's fiction, which I would say is definitely going to be much harder than nonfiction, because you deal with nonfiction daily, especially as a therapist, right? So you're used to those stories. But moving them forward, it sounds like fiction to me, at least. Am I right or no?
Yeah. No, you're right. And so the book that I'm writing is the book that I needed after having my second daughter, because I definitely had a touch of postpartum. I didn't know that postpartum wasn't just sadness. I always pictured it to be, you know, well, you have symptoms of depression. But for me, postpartum, I had this rage that I had never felt before. I had anger issues, and just, it was like when people talk about seeing red, that was me during that time. Anything could set me off. And then when I was, you know, flipping shit, I felt completely entitled to it. I knew it was wrong, but I still felt like I was entitled to behave that way. And I knew something was off, but I didn't connect. Given my background, you think I would have, but I never connected postpartum with rage, because no one had ever talked about that before. So during that time, I have shelves covered with personal development books, fiction too, but a lot of personal development. And if someone would have given me a personal, like a nonfiction self-help book, I just wouldn't have done it. I was not in the headspace to be able to follow through on that. But if you gave me a story about a woman who reminds me of me and where I'm at that time, and there's a little bit of spice and, you know, a little bit of scandal, and integrate this roadmap as to how to get out of this icky state that I was in, I would read that book.
Nice. Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, that's the, for writing, coming from a place of self need is always a great place to start, right? Because that's huge. So I love it.
Yeah. It's so much fun. And I, you know, we'll see what happens with it. I don't have any, of course, like the ego has desires and expectations that come out of it. But for the most part, you know, the intention is to just write a book that helps people and entertains them at the same time.
Awesome.
That's the goal. So we'll see.
Cool. Well, let's touch a little bit on fears. Any particular fears that you are interested in or want to share with us? Anything you experience?
Oh, you know, I should have thought that you might ask me a question about fear.
It's in the title.
Yeah, that should have connected. I'm like, fear.
The answer, not right now, is perfectly fine too.
Yeah. No, I would say it's, given my childhood, you know, my fear would be to come to the end of my life and have all my hopes. Les Brown always tells the story of, you know, being on your deathbed and having goals and aspirations and wishes and plans just kind of surrounding you, saying we've been with you, achievements, and, you know, with you your whole life, and you never used us. We were there, you know. And so to me, my biggest fear is to not fulfill that soul's purpose, which I know sounds woo-woo-y, but it really is. But I tend to be, it's almost like a hazard how fearless I am with things. I think it's again, the byproduct of a chaotic childhood. But this, I don't know. I don't really say no to things, you know, that come up because I feel afraid. To me, the scarier part is the regret that would come from not doing them.
Yeah, I mean, I know a few people much more in your camp, right? That just kind of are adventurous or are willing to try. The fear doesn't really come in. I'm hoping that more of us can move towards that, right? Like this lockdown and everything has brought out fears that for me that I didn't know I had. And I mean, I have a crippling fear now of trying to teach a 5-year-old, you know, phonics, because it's just not in my wheelhouse, right? And you overcome that, though. You take a breath, you go and research, you listen to how the teacher's doing it, you know, during the virtual class online, and you go in and you make adjustments, right? And so I guess for me, what fear is starting to evolve in is just minor adjustments in how I view things, which has helped me, because I used to think, even at the start of this project, that I needed to have wholesale change or something dramatic, right, happen in order to overcome a fear. And that's just not how it works. It's tiny little steps. It's little nuances throughout the day. And I'm seeing that more and more. And, you know, when I talked to Dava Sylvia on one of our episodes, and she talked about her fear of flying and how she kind of took these steps to overcome that and, you know, fly a little further and get on, you know, just even going to the airport, big deal, right? Getting on the plane, big deal. Even if she got on and walked off, it probably would have been like an accomplishment at that point, right?
Right.
And I think that too often we're looking for this, like, you know, somebody overcame their fear of heights because they jumped out of an airplane with, you know, the parachute on, and that's it. Like, it's gone. It's just magic. And that's not really how fear works, or life for that matter. So, you know, it's a big difference. Right. But talking to somebody like you, that really fear is defined in a different way. And I'm sure you see it in patients, you know, and other people that you talk to, but it's just not something that defines your life.
No. And it can be problematic, the fearlessness piece, because it is the thing that has me saying, and this is something I've really discovered in the last couple of years, that I get excited. And so I go, oh, that seems like that's going to be so much fun. I'm going to do that. And then I cause all of this chaos in the process. And then I complain that I don't have the time for things that matter to me. Right. So the big thing for me now that I'm working on, and it's part of, you know, the 2021 plan, is what are my priorities? And then how do I translate those priorities into a routine? So, you know, there might be some sort of subconscious fear of routine and boredom and lack of chaos. That's a possibility. I haven't really thought about that before, but that's definitely, you know, an available option.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I hear you. I'm trying to get better with, it's funny because you're trying to look at routine more, and I'm trying to get better at there's not routine because of the chaos in the world. Routine is out the window. Example, I mean, I keep coming back to the school, but it's so dominant in my life, right? Because to remind anybody who, or if you're just tuning in, I have two older kids. They're in school. They're in high school 5 days a week, 3 hours a day. Everything's fine. Zero transmission at the school. They're learning. Everything's good. I also have a kindergartner, because who doesn't want, you know, 9 or 10 years between kids? And she has been virtual and then hybrid for 2 days and then back to virtual. But in that realm, there's been six different schedules. Six schedules.
Right.
We're only 9 or 10 weeks into this, and you're already on your sixth different schedule that you've handed out. That's tough for somebody like me. I needed, okay, this is the schedule for the year. This is when I can schedule my time to do other things. So my wife, Gretchen, fantastic. She's, you know, a senior director of finance in a big company. And I left my job before this happened to do podcasting. And also, though, I have to make money, because let me tell you, podcasting, zero money. And I found that out, and that's okay. Like, I do this now because I want to do it.
Right.
But I still have to make some kind of money. So I'm having trouble finding times to work because by the time the school day is done, I'm exhausted, just like a teacher would be, right? Because I've been there the whole time. Mm-hmm. I'm helping. I'm teaching. So I'm trying to find a way, okay, when you change that schedule on me and I now can't pinpoint time, how do I get better with chaos? How do I get better with constant change? So it's interesting because I think that you, it's probably not fun for you to see different schedules from, you know, kids, teachers or virtual or whatever, but I think that you kind of have the tools probably that can cope with it a little bit better than I could because I don't thrive in that environment. I'm much more A, B, C, D. That's the day.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm definitely, so here's the thing though, if I was able to get myself to have a little bit of structure and routine and I followed that consistently, like an adult ought to, right? then maybe I would find myself not handling the shit show that is a virtual well. But because it's a shit show all the time anyway,
right,
you know?
Right, right. That's a good point.
Yeah, so let me just shatter the illusion that your therapist has it together. Like, we all have our own issues. That's why we got into therapy. But, yeah, so to be able to, I think that then I would probably be aggravated by that, you know? But for me, the hardest part with, because my daughter just started virtual hybrid this week. So she's going, I have a first grader and a sixth grader. The sixth grader, they're starting them later in November, but with hybrid. But the first grader started going this week and I'm not there, which was difficult for me to manage. But from what I've seen over the last couple of weeks, because we've had a lot of change in schedule too, the whole thing's just stressful, you know, but the mental load, that's what I was going to say. The mental load that is required of us when the teacher says, you know, the teacher and my daughter's Addison, her teacher is a rock star. I mean, we are so lucky to have her this year, but when she puts out stuff and she lists everything clearly, but then I don't know what something means, the aggravation that boils up inside me over that is just, you know, and I think that's part of that mental load that parents are experiencing right now.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think you brought up a really good point. Like, teachers, the change is happening for them too. Like, this is not a knock on the teachers themselves. It's not even a knock on administrations. Look, there's no good and easy answers at this point. We can agree to disagree on a lot of stuff, right? But the one thing that we're not going to disagree on, I don't think, across the country, is that education is important for children, regardless of mm-hmm. how it occurs. And kids are both thrive in routine. Most kids thrive in routine. And yes. are at the same time amazingly resilient. And that's what has amazed me the most, is watching the resiliency and the go with the flow from my 5-year-old, so it's like, I'm the one with the, like, I can't believe this. And yeah, when you don't understand like what something means, or if they left like one thing off or whatever, it's like this anxiety builds up, this rage sometimes builds up, like, why can't mm-hmm. you get this right? And then I have to stop and think, and I've become much more empathetic as I've gotten older. Like, okay, what is that teacher going through? Why would they have made a mistake for this that they typically wouldn't make? Well, these 800 other things happened that they're not mm-hmm. used to. They've never taught virtual. They don't know what they're doing either, right? So they're doing the best that they can. I do think, though, that as a society, we need to be more empathetic just overall about this situation that we are in, pandemic, election, whatever it is, right? And we need to give a little bit more grace and a little bit more mercy to ourselves and to others so that we can all settle down. Because I can tell you right now, I mean, anybody who listens to me knows I've ranted about social media many, many times. You and I have talked about it, you know, off air, Nicole. Mm-hmm. The fact is that when we talk, like you talked at the beginning about like what we think we should be accomplishing, you know, being shut up and, you know, being in lockdown. Well, that's because people are Instagramming their perfect life on it, you know, mm-hmm. that they did these 800 things. And we're like, well, why didn't I do 800 things? Well, they did 800 things, but they didn't show you that, you know, dinner burned and their kids refused to eat it. And a temper tantrum was thrown, and you know, it's the background, the facade that is social media, I think just makes life more difficult than ever because we just end up comparing. Right. And that goes for school too. I see, you know, people posting about how great their kids are doing and thriving in virtual environments. And I'm like, well, you know, my kid's okay. She's okay. Mm-hmm. But that, you know what? Okay is fine. That's just fine. Okay is good. And she'll be good, but it's hard to remember that in the moment where she's struggling. So
well, yeah, and it brings up all of those feelings of inadequacy and being able to, you know, wanting to be able to help her and then worrying, because as soon as the part of the brain that suffers is triggered, it doesn't just stop, it snowballs. And it goes from, I don't know why she doesn't understand it. The teacher explained it three times. I've told her, I don't know how to help her. And then you sort of get into that panic thing. And then the mind will snowball that story. It'll just keep growing until it's the long-term impacts of this day on her future. Right?
Right.
And so it's really hard, I think, to... And this goes back to that idea of filling up the tank. I can't be a good parent from an empty tank. I just can't. It's when I'm yelling. It's when I'm, you know, it's when I'm who I swore I would never be as. I was a great parent before I had kids, right? You know, I was an amazing mom. But now it's, I can't do it. And that's the thing, the getting away from 3 days has really solidified for me. Like, I have to figure out a way to manage this and carve out, and I have to stop being, like I said, precious. You know, it has to be good enough, some of the things that that are, you know, we do when we try to fill up the tank. But yeah, I think this whole situation's just bringing out all of the stuff that we've been able to bury under busy,
right? That's a really good point. That's a really good point. Yeah. Well, speaking of buried, is there anything that I didn't ask about or that you haven't shared that we just absolutely need to know about you?
Let's see. Oh, well, I'm like, do I put this out here for accountability purposes? I don't know. So I was a runner for 20 years. And is that how we connected? Was it through the running group?
I'm sure. Are you in sub 30 probably?
Yeah. And so I'd run for 20 years. And then we bought this house. Pennsylvania is so different from Jersey. It's so weird, but we bought this house and it, in this neighborhood, it was like kind of in the forest. We've since moved. But it didn't have sidewalks and it was at the top of a hill. So no matter what way I was running, and it wasn't just a hill, it was like the steepest peak in the township that I live in. And so I would have to drive to run, and it just became, it just became a problem, you know, because my husband travels for work a lot. So I have the girls solo and they're still little. And so I've sort of fallen out of sorts with running, even though I know it's one of the things that makes me feel so good. So that's something I'm trying to get back into. I don't know that people needed to know that about me.
I think it's important because, you know, there's a lot of runners who listen just because of the communities that, I've been in. So plenty of runners. Matter of fact, I'm not sure that any guest has been on that, maybe one or two that have not been part of a running community in one way or another. So I think it's a big deal. I've struggled back and forth with it myself lately and can't wait to kind of get that routine back myself. So that's something we'll both be working on.
Well, you said your heart rate goes up, right?
Yeah, I've been having, I had that issue. I had everything checked out. Everything checked out fine. Like no issues. I actually thought I might have had COVID, like way early on. I got the antibody test and I don't have any antibodies, but I was told that that just means that they could be gone. That doesn't necessarily mean that you didn't have that. It could have been some other virus that did it, or it could just be age and nutrition and weight. And that's the side my doctor is on. He's like, look, you're almost 50. You got to shed some pounds. And, you know, genetics just tell me that you probably haven't had a lot of people running marathons at 50 in your family. So he's like, just be a little gentle and do what you can. So I've actually found a joy in walking again and hiking. Mm-hmm. I love it. And, you know, I'm looking at how do I incorporate, you know, other things, cycling, which I used to do a lot of. And I'm just trying to find other ways. But running, even if it's only 2 or 3 days a week for me, I still need to do some, as long as I can. And, you know, I just, I got to see if the heart rate can get under control, maybe with just, you know, doing what the doctor has ordered, which is, well, I can't do anything about the age. That 50 is coming up fast and there's nothing I can do about it. But the nutrition and the weight, you know, that's something I can continue to work on. So that's kind of where that is.
Well, it's interesting. So I guess I can add this piece to it so people can learn this. So my areas of expertise clinically are, I do a lot of work with ADHD, grief and loss, and body image, self-esteem, eating disorders. And not so much anorexia, but more of the binging type, that realm of eating disorders. And so I work with a lot of people who come in who are definitely curvy. I myself am a curvier girl, thanks perimenopause. But that's been, I've always find it interesting when doctors, you know, because there is some research that talks about those who are a normal to overweight. And I'm not talking like you can't buckle your seatbelt on the airplane overweight, just a general, you know, curviness, often do better health wise in certain situations than those who are of weight or underweight. And I always find it interesting when doctors blame weight for things. And my question to them when they do that, or to people who do that, is, you know, what would you say how would you solve this problem if I was of the perfect weight? Because I think a lot of times that weight stigma gets in the way, and the assumption it goes to weight right away.
Yeah.
You know, but it doesn't, the research doesn't always show that the weight is the variable that's causing the problem.
Yeah, that's interesting, because the conversation with my doctor was very similar to that. So, you know, what he said to me was, look, you've got 50 extra pounds right now. So that to me tells me that, you know, from like a quote unquote normal weight, he goes, I'm not telling you to lose 50, but if you lose 25 and you're still having the problems, now I could start to narrow it down because your blood flow should be better by then. You know, there's some other pieces of that. He's like, my problem is that I can't rule out that that's an issue. Like I can't get to the heart of what might of what might be going on, because there's this layer in there that is definitely a strong variable, at least in his mind, right? And even if I lost 25 pounds, I'd still be overweight. So I kind of accept like that answer for this time. Where I didn't accept it at first was, he basically told me like, look, there's nothing wrong. And I'm like, look, there is something wrong. Like I've run ultra marathons recently and it changed like it was a switch. Like I was fine. Now I'm not. So that's not right. Not when I've been running long distances. And I mean, okay, I'm not sprinting, but my heart rate's not going up when I'm sprinting. The problem has been my heart rate is going up, almost staying there, no matter what speed I'm going, if it's not a walk. That's not right. So, and he's like, oh yeah, that's definitely not right. But you could, and on the treadmill test, you know, and all that, you could see, you know, there's no problem with the heart itself And they just kept saying, well, you're just out of shape. I'm like, that's not true. So I am, right. You know, at the point where I've just got to accept that that's the path, or find a different doctor and see if we can get to it. But part of that is going to be for me, though. I do feel better when I am about 20 pounds lighter than what I am now. And I need to do that. Mm-hmm. 20 or 25 pounds. I'm good with doing that right from here. And then we'll reexamine it. But the mental health benefits of trying and getting out there are so much outweigh the physical discomfort. As long as mm-hmm. I know there's not a structural problem, I'm not having a heart attack, I'm going to give it a go. Right.
Yeah. So I love that you followed your intuition, you know, and you kind of kept poking, because I know a lot of people who wouldn't do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think that's another piece of it, right? Like, there's this stigma that, okay, you had a heart attack. Like that was something that, you know, if you would have died, like, what if I would have eaten broccoli more times and been 50 pounds less, I wouldn't have had the heart attack? Well, I don't know, because I care about the structure of the heart. And right. I think that that's, it kind of, to me, mirrors the mental health side, right? Like, I don't choose to be depressed. Like, who the fuck would choose to be depressed? Like, that's ridiculous. We don't choose this shit. It happens. And there's reasons for it. So we have to explore what those reasons are. And we may never have an answer. Like, to this moment, like, why do I get depressed? No idea. Right? It's because mm-hmm. it's not situational depression. I could mm-hmm. be perfectly happy, have everybody around me that loves me, and then just have this overwhelming feeling of sadness or anger or some emotion that's like just out of the blue. That's what depression is. And, you know, my biggest fear is that, like, I hate that feeling so much, and it's not understood even within mm-hmm. family. To this moment, when something happens, Gretchen will ask me, what's wrong? And I'm like, I don't know. Nothing's wrong. Right. Like, it's part of the issue. So,
yeah.
And she doesn't mean to do, I mean, believe me, that's not a knock on Gretchen. She's normal. That's the normal question from mm-hmm. 99% of society. Right. And, you know, there's interestingly, I wasn't going to, I mean, this has gone way out of just talking about you, but I think it's good for this to be out there, especially this time, at this moment in time. But there was recently from Brené Brown, who I love. I think she's absolutely fantastic, but she had this meme that she had put on LinkedIn, and it rubbed me the wrong way. And I posted about it, and it got a really long discussion happen. But it was basically to the point of, let me look, you know, let me find it. I think that would probably be better. Mm-hmm. If I actually,
I remember that.
So, and I posted this and, I posted this in the No Fear Project, and you commented on it. Actually. Mm-hmm. So it said, caution, if you trade in your authenticity for being liked, you may experience the following: anxiety, depression, addiction, rage, blame, resentment, and inexplicable grief. Mm-hmm. On the surface, that seems spot on. Where my fear came in is that people would take that from somebody like Brené Brown saying, look, if you're authentic, you will not experience these things. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if you do, you must be inauthentic and you must have a problem. I know that's not what she meant, but I can tell you right now, reading through the 1,310 comments, that most people were like, fuck yeah, you better mm-hmm. be authentic and then you're going to be great. And I'm like, whoa. I hope you're not tying this to, I hope you're not tying authenticity and somehow saying like that's going to stop mental health issues, because that's just not true. And I know that's not what she meant. I was really hoping her or whoever manages her social media was going to respond, hey, it's a meme. Here's the context of that meme. Mm-hmm. But this is why memes and social are dangerous. Even LinkedIn is dangerous at this point because of that. But it did get a really good discussion around, hey, I recovered from depression. Okay, great. That's fantastic for you. It worked for you. You finding your authentic self, you had situations that made you depressed. But for me, it's not situational depression. It's clinical.
Right.
And I find those kinds of comments dangerous, right? And right. It was a very long string. I mean, there must be 30 comments, like, back and forth from people on my comment. And most of it, some of it was to defend Brené Brown, right? They thought I was attacking Brené Brown, which I'm not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think we could use another, you know, billion Brené Browns in the world, personally.
Right.
She's awesome. Yeah. I know that's not what she meant. I was pointing out for people who read that and think like everything goes away if you live some sort of perfect life, it's just not true. So
mm-hmm.
Anyway, I've started to speak up more, even with having that fear, but I also fear that not having situational depression, and I don't know if that's the clinical term, it's just a term that I use, right? Versus clinical depression, mm-hmm. where this is an ongoing thing for me. I think they're kind of getting, I think the waters are getting muddied here in 2020 because people are, for the first time, experiencing depression-like symptoms, anxiety symptoms because of the situation that we're in versus everything's great and I still have this problem. Rant over.
Right. Right. No, and it is, you know, and I think people throw the terminology around, you know, very easily. You know, I'm so depressed. Like, you're just having a touch of sadness, right? But, and then compare that to someone who again meets the criteria for the diagnosis. But I think that I love that you brought up was the authenticity aspect. Like, you can be, and I think this is one of the things I try really hard to do with my own social media is I try to be authentic, which means that you're not going to have the privilege of not seeing the train wreck, right? Because sometimes there are weeks where it just feels like hot mess 24/7. And then other times it's not. Other times I get it together. And that's sort of, I think, the human experience for people, that all of the stuff that we do is a practice. But I think you can be authentic and still be a mess. Right.
I don't think anybody would ever accuse me of not being authentic. I mean, I'm pretty much out there, and you know, my social almost doesn't exist. I mean, I mostly am in groups at this point, or I'll post a few things about kids or what have you, but I'm not even really on there anymore. I don't look at it. It makes my life better to not look at it. You know, and
no,
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. No, I was saying with the Brené Brown quote,
yeah.
You know, I think that's not like her style to post like that. I'm surprised by that sort of cheekiness there.
I'm pretty sure it's not
with her.
I'm pretty sure it's a social media manager of some sort, right? That was an awful meme. I don't care what anybody says. I can hear mm-hmm. your side and vehemently disagree. It mm-hmm. to me, it's just, it was bad, right? And I do know what she meant because I've read enough Brené Brown books to know what the context was of that quote, right?
Right.
I'm also probably somebody who has over the years become protective, or as you've said, precious, right, about certain mm-hmm. things. And this, to me, I'll give the parallel. When somebody tells me they have a migraine and they've just had an entire day, done everything, ran 10 miles, you didn't have a migraine. You had mm-hmm. a headache, a bad headache maybe, but not a migraine. Because as a migraine sufferer, I can tell you are knocked on your butt. There are mm-hmm. degrees of migraine, absolutely. But migraines are pretty rare. They're about, you know, less than 5% of headaches. You probably didn't have a migraine, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you tell me you're depressed, I'm going to ask follow-up questions to not to try to get you, but to help you understand, like, if you are depressed, like, you should probably get some help, versus I'm having a bad day and I'm a little sad,
right? You know,
or a lot sad or super sad, mm-hmm. but sad and depression are not synonyms. Depression rears its head in many other ways. So, mm-hmm. And for me, depression comes into play and triggers other fears. So that's to me how it all ties together, is when I'm in that state of depression, like I am so fearful of almost everything else because I'm afraid I'm going to screw it up because I'm not my best self at that moment in time, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's to me like a big crux of kind of where I think that we've headed with this podcast. Although I would love to have more common everyday fears to talk to people about.
Mm-hmm.
Fear of flying, fear of heights, you know, all that. But there are those really deep down, super rooted fears, you know, of, you know, that cause other mental illnesses to spike. Fear of death, mm-hmm. you know, fear of success, fear of failure, all those types of things. So, you know, I think we've got no end of subject matter.
I know, it's so exciting, right? There's just so much messes to be explored. It's great.
Absolutely. And that's really the call out here, is if you wanted to share your story, your fears, and it doesn't have to be a fear like, oh yeah, I had this fear and I've conquered it. You can come out and be a mess. Like, absolutely. Like, we'll talk and try to bring out exactly what's going on. Not from a therapist perspective. This is not therapy. This is storytelling. So let's be clear. Right. There's ethical boundaries around therapy and we are not going to cross them. So, mm-hmm. But definitely in terms of just talking, like people talking and bringing out a story, but we need to hear from you. So if you want to share anything, send a note to me or to Nicole or write in the No Fear Project messenger and let us know. And, you know, we'll definitely get you on the schedule to be on air if that's what you would like to do. And other than that, that's the big message I wanted to give out. Oh, I guess going forward too, we want to do this on a weekly basis, starting in a few weeks, but it may not happen, right? There's 2020, there's remote school, there's holidays and all that. But we will do the best that we can to get episodes out there. But just be patient, because it's the way it is. Our goal is to bring you really good content and then tie it up with some actionable items at the end. That's mm-hmm. really where I think Nicole and I, where we are very similar, and mm-hmm. that I love, is that stories are great, but you got to have some sort of call to action or it's right. almost not worth it.
Right. Right, because then it's just the same thing over and over again. It's like, but what do we do?
Exactly.
Right? People want to know what to do. So, or at least I know I always want to. I'm like, okay, that's all lovely, but tell me what to do.
Yeah. So, all right, cool. Well,
try.
I'm thinking we could wrap it up. What do you think?
Sounds good. This was fun.
Yeah, good conversation. And so this show will come out kind of right away. But look for us to start putting out episodes more like mid-November is my guess. Just because we got to get, you've got an adjustment with your schedule. I've got one with mine now again, and I've just got to figure out a good time to record.
Yeah. And it's going to keep changing. So yeah,
absolutely.
I think it's great that everyone's, you know, we appreciate all of your flexibility out there.
Yeah.
So thank you.
And look, the group is just, that's the part to me that's really the best thing mm-hmm. that came out of this entire thing. And it's people mm-hmm. posting about their deep fears, things that are going on in their lives, and it's 100% safe. And I'm shocked. I've only seen two kind of posts or comments that have been political in nature, because we don't do politics in the No Fear mm-hmm. Project. Like, you can right. phrase it differently, right? And I've deleted those and let people know why. You know, but other than that, it's pretty much fair game in there.
I love it. It reminds me of, do you remember the show The Real World?
Yeah.
When people would go and they would, I always wanted to be the person who added the music to The Real World, just sidebar. But because it always had, like, especially the first season had such cool music. But I love, you know, when they would go into the confessional and they would just sort of unload whatever it was that they were holding on to. And I feel like that's my favorite part of the No Fear Project group, is that it's like people just go in and they're like, here's all this shit. I don't feel like I just can't keep it in anymore. So I'm going to release it. And then there's such a lightness that comes when you do that.
Yeah.
You know, and then the connection and the empathy that comes from the other members of the group, I think, you know, it's how people who maybe hide sometimes, something like a safe space like that is where people start to trust small pieces of the universe again. And so I just love so much that you do that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a we, right? It's definitely transcended me. I put the project out there. I put the group out there, but now it's evolved. I mean, I just kind of try to help, you know, spur some conversation, but man, it's, it's really good. It's doing great. So if you haven't joined, definitely give it a look.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, let's wrap up this episode. I want to thank our Patreon supporters. You make the group and show possible. A special welcome to Team E4E Wellness as our executive producer. And we want to thank our other producer, the Money, Motivation, and Motherhood podcast. And want to tell you about our companion podcast, The Fat Man Chronicles, that I do with my wife, Gretchen. And also That Wine Pod, because I do love wine. I've been in the wine business a long time. And I have a podcast with my buddy, Vino Mike, over there. Big thing is to be sure to subscribe to the No Fear Project on your favorite podcast app. Leave a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. It really does help people find the show. And finally, remember, the way forward is together. The time to conquer is now.
Thank you for listening to the No Fear Project. Original music is from Josh and Dean. Join us on social media by searching the No Fear Project on Facebook and Instagram. Check out thenofearproject.com for more information, including in-person presentations on fear customized for your organization. The No Fear Project is committed to helping those with mental illness get help and to defeating the stigma. If you have any thoughts of harming yourself or suicide, please contact the Suicide Prevention Hotline for help now at 800-273-8255. Remember, you are not alone. The No Fear Project is a production of Paragon Media, all rights reserved.